Dumb tea, it is pouring. And it's done this before. That shouldn't strike me as so novel, but it's been so long since we've had a day-long deluge that I don't remember what this is like.
I'm telling you.
It'd be on a Saturday.
I didn't expect it to start off this gloomy today.
I know. Thunder and lightning last night. Bingo and Daisy were worried about it, and so they got up. That means Brenda got up. That means I got up. Well, that's a lot of fun for the whole family.
Yikes. How you doing this morning, John?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Actually, Brenda had to stay up. I was the one that went back to sleep.
John, it rained all day on Wednesday. The Cubs were rained out.
Actually, yeah, now that you mention it.
I mean, I just got to, well, we got to have accuracy going on here.
This is from the weather sports department.
That's
hi,
right.
Mark Carmen.
What is this water falling from the sky? What is it? What in the world?
Actually, it was so miserable Wednesday, thank you for that, Carm, that walking out of the station that afternoon, somebody came up to me and said, hey, you want some tickets to the playoffs? That's how lousy Wednesday was. I said, well, okay. So I buzzed home. I said, hey, Brenda, I know it's the second inning, but let's go to the game. She goes, great. She grabbed a raincoat, and we got there to the third. We sat in that cold, miserable, blowing rain until the post-Grand Slam inning. So we were there to the top of the ninth.
That was Thursday.
Was that? Yeah, Thursday.
That was Thursday. Rain all day Wednesday. Wednesday was the rain out.
Oh, rain out. And then Thursday was the rainy game.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's been raining a lot lately, and I'm quite familiar with the concept.
How come you didn't? I could have used a text. I would have come and said hi. We could have had been in the rain together on Thursday, John.
I guess I should have assumed you would have been at the game.
Well, I mean,
you go to all of the games, given your sports stature and all.
Well, I was not. I was there in a sitting variety capacity for round one. I'll be a working member of the media starting on Tuesday. So there's that. And if you want to really delve into my life, I feel like I've already
told more about it than is necessary.
Yes, I'm going too far. I was in the upper deck. I was in the lower deck. I walked around.
Got it.
I was proud of myself, and then.
Like a real person.
Yeah, a real person.
Speaking of the Cubs, I interviewed this week Rich Cohen. I don't know if you had a chance to hear the interviewer. He's the essayist, author, magazine writer. And his latest book is The Chicago Cubs Story of a Curse, Rich Cohen. And as much as Domati's story makes me think that that Rita Crundwell story really should be a movie, Rita Crundwell, the treasurer in Dixon, who actually ripped off a town more than any civil employee, civil servant, has ever ripped off a town. Dixon, Illinois, $50 million. For 2 years, the cops didn't get a raise or have new radios. You know, they had to lay off municipal workers. In a decade, they only repaired about 50 or 60 streets because they never had the money. Where's the money? Boy, it's tough times for Dixon, Illinois. The treasurer, comptroller, was stealing from them. And she had this quarter horse business, and she liked nice clothes and fancy glasses, and she had a swell life and nice cars, and everybody thought, well, that's her good fortune. And they didn't think, gee, that's weird, because she's the Dixon comptroller, but she's really doing well here. She ripped them off to the tune of $50 million, and now the movie being made about it is All the Queen's Horses. Isn't that a great title? I hope the movie is good. Another story that they need to make maybe another movie about is the story of the Chicago Cubs and the book that Rich Cohen wrote. Not because there haven't been stories or books written about baseball or the Cubs or the curse. I suppose there have. But because the book is just so dang good. And what I like about it, and I don't know, again, if you heard our conversation earlier this week, you can go to WGNradio.com, check out my podcast, and you'll hear the interview that we did with Rich Cohen. But what I like about this book, it's not real long, it's just a couple hundred pages, is that he spends the first 50 pages of the book talking about the 06, 07, 08 Cubs. He said, arguably, the best ball team ever. Tinker Evers Chance. Three-finger Mordecai Brown was on that team. If you really want to know how great it is that we won it in 1916 and how long we waited, you also should appreciate how great we were when we were in the World Series for those 3 years. And I think all of us know that much, and then we don't know anything else. You know, Mark Carmen probably does because he's a sports guy.
I got huge knowledge on those teams. They were awesome.
I didn't really know a lot about it. So I'm plowing through this thing, you know, waiting to get to Rizzo and or Sam Sianis in the GOAT. And there he is educating me. And so here's just a few notes about it from me. And they should make just the first 50 pages of this book the movie. I want the full movie. I want the Robert Redford, I want the Field of Dreams. I want some sort of, you know, hazy, gauzy, wonderful telling of the 06, 07, 08 with a rich score, you know, and sunsets in a cornfield. I don't know how they're going to do this, but I want it to feel like one of those great baseball movies. You had Joe Tinker at shortstop, Johnny Evers at second base. Some say Johnny Evers was the smallest person to ever play baseball. In stature and size, he was just puny. But he was also a mean son of a gun. And then big Frank Chance at first base, who was well-to-do. He was educated. He was handsome as a movie star. The three of them were admitted to the Hall of Fame as a unit. That's how cohesive they were. Franklin Pierce Adams, the columnist, wrote a poem about it because if you hit a ground ball to that infield and a runner was on, you knew it was going to be a double play. They called it Tinker to Evers to Chance. These are the saddest of possible words. Tinker to Evers to Chance. Trio of Cubs and fleeter than birds. Tinker to Evers to Chance. Words that are heavy with nothing but trouble. Tinker to Evers to Chance. And the interesting thing he says is that they hated each other. As much as the current version of the Cubs are affectionate and like each other, and you can tell, Tinker and Evers didn't speak for decades, and they were playing next to each other in the middle of the infield. They once got into an argument about a cab ride, and Tinker said to Evers afterwards when they were in the dugout, "Look, you and I don't like each other. Let's just play and not talk." And Evers said, "That suits me fine," and they didn't speak again. Mordecai Brown was on that team, whose hand was mangled in a farming accident as a child. His parents rushed him to a Civil War surgeon who saved the hand and part of some fingers, but the paw was so misformed that he couldn't throw a ball without spinning it. Well, how convenient, and in unusual ways, at an era where spitballs were legal. Ty Cobb said he was the hardest to hit pitcher he ever saw, and yet Mordecai Brown almost never got to pitch. He was playing for the town's coal mining team, the story is told by Rich Cohen. And the coach said, "Well, I'm not going to let you pitch because of that hand of yours." July 7th, 1898, the team's pitcher breaks his arm, fielding a bunt, and an old-timer tells the coach, "If you let that kid pitch, you'll win the game." The coach did, and the kid did, and he became a legend. And next thing you know, he's playing with Tinker Evers and Chance. And then, so then you tell the story about them winning the games, and some of the games and some of the stuff that happened you would not believe, including Merkel's Boner. And if you just joined us, Merkel's Boner is a baseball play. And then the movie should end with what happened to these guys afterwards. Johnny Evers was driving his car one day. He gets in a crash. His friend is sitting next to him, and his friend is killed. Evers is distraught. He has a nervous breakdown. He's committed. Eventually, he comes back to play for the Boston Braves, and he wins the MVP award. Joe Tinker, the guy he would never speak to again, worked as a boiler inspector for the Air Force. And in fact, before he died, Evers visits him in a room. He comes back to him, but he's here, he's ailing, and he goes to visit him. And the two of them are alone and again in a room together for the first time in years, and they fell into each other's arms weeping. Frank Chance was hit in the head so many times in an era without helmets that one day he collapsed on the field, July of 1911, with a blood clot in his brain. He survived that day but died young at the age of 48. And Three Finger Brown, Mordecai Brown's a great story too, came up from a coal mining town team, playing for the coal mining company in town, to the Bush Leagues, to the minor leagues, to the pros, to the Hall of Fame. And he loved the game so much he came down the same way. And you imagine a modern player today doing what he did then, but he got kicked back to the minors, and then he played in the Bush Leagues, and then he was in barnstorming exhibition games, and he ended his life pitching for the Havilenes, the oil company, in a factory league in Indiana. And when he couldn't play that anymore, he ran a Texaco gas station. Mordecai Brown. So I said to him, "Well, just make the movie about that. Forget the GOAT. Forget the 1916 World Series. I want to see that story told well." One other note, and we'll pause here, and that is that I am on Tuesday going to also visit with Pamela Banos, from Northwestern University, an art historian. She's written a book about Vivian Maier. This is a great Chicago story, too, isn't it? Vivian Maier is the woman whose photographs were recently unearthed and became the subject of a who owns the photographs and what are we going to do with them. But they're spectacular pictures. So you've probably heard the name Vivian Maier, and maybe you've seen the pictures. It was a decade ago next week that the pictures were first sold at one of those, you know, locker auctions where the people don't pay the bills, so they cut off the lock. You can peek in, you can look, but you can't touch. And she had five lockers of her cameras, of her magazines and books, of her photographs, and of her undeveloped film. That was the treasure trove. And a guy peeks in, and he says, okay, I'll give you $260 for the five stalls. And he walks away with that treasure trove. And I love that, at least in the beginning of the book, Pamela tells us the story about how did that happen? How did Vivian Maier not pay that bill and leave all of that stuff there? And then this guy just happens upon it. And then it goes from him to some other guys, and they don't really know what they have. One of the guys buys all of the photographs and the negatives, and he runs an ad in the paper. Oil paintings, etchings, old photos, old stamps, many books and 30s and 40s and 50s magazines, newspapers, and some really great history here, knickknacks and whatnots. If you'd thought that that was the Vivian Maier collection, you would be rich today. Or maybe not. We'll visit with the author who tells the story of Vivian Maier on my 1 o'clock show Tuesday afternoon. It's 10:22. One last note about Wrigley Field here, and that is that we're talking this week about great places to eat around the ballpark. You know, you can get a beer and a burger and a brat. But we asked the restaurant critic of the Chicago Tribune to give us some decent, some better places to eat, and he had a nice list. Get your number two pencils ready. I'll give you a couple of places that are worth your money and while around Wrigley Field. Two food notes for you. We asked Phil Vitale, the restaurant critic at the Tribune, to give us some good places to eat around Wrigley Field. He said he likes Wood on North Halsted. He was recommending Yoshi's Cafe, 3257 North Halsted. Tango Sur on Southport, just a little west of the park. Mia Francesca, he has good things to say about the whole chain, and the one nearest the park, 3311 North Clark Street, he said it's really good, 3311 North Clark. Uncommon Ground, which isn't just a coffee place, you go by there, it's pretty big. He said the food in there is not bad. Uncommon Ground, 3800 North Clark, and HB Bistro, 3404 North Halsted. A few recommendations there for you. He said Wood, Yoshi's Cafe, Tango Sur, Mia Francesca, Uncommon Ground, HB Bistro. By the way, since it's Halloween time, do you guys have a Domitique Griff? Do you have a favorite candy? I don't know if you saw on the Twitter, but for some reason this week I decided to post my list of if candy were currency denominations, the penny through the $100 bill. And in my world, the $1 bill, the thing by which all things are measured, our most common currency will be the Hershey bar.
Mm-hmm.
Are we all okay with
that? That's pretty accurate.
I think that's kind of where America is.
I think I like that. I think candy corn would definitely be the penny.
It was the penny, and then I had to move it, Domitique, for this reason. I've got Jelly Bellies there.
Yeah, okay. That's debatable. But Jelly Bellies are so much better than candy
corn.
Yeah,
they are better.
I put it in sports terms, John. The one seed for me is the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup.
Right.
The two seed is the Snickers bar, and you really don't need to go any further than that.
That's it.
Your bracket.
And one of those are going to win, huh? It doesn't matter after that.
Yeah, I mean, I flip back and forth. They're just so
solid.
But
every now and then you get a gummy bear that sort of upsets it, and the next thing you know, your world's upside down.
This is true.
You guys need to know that John freezes all of his chocolate. He puts it all in the freezer. So this whole thing is moot. It's all
nothing beats a frozen.
I don't know.
Reese's
Thank
cup.
You, Domitique. Thank
the
you.
Best.
I really disagree. I don't like it frozen.
In fact, my $10 bill, if candy were currency, is a frozen Three Musketeer bar.
Oh, without question.
Because then you take it out. You can eat it like a popsicle, or you can gently let it thaw. And each bite is its own sort of longer lasting. nougaty goodness.
This is horrifying to listen to.
It is, kind of, isn't it? I'm sorry I did that. I'm sorry. But listen anyway, folks. So I have, as the penny, the Jelly Belly, your smallest denomination. The nickel is the Skittle. I mean, how do you not have a Skittle in there? Then I went with the candy corn Domati. Hate me. And then I've got the gummy bear as your quarter. The Hershey bar is our American dollar. I have the Baby Ruth, the Frozen Three Musketeer. Carm, you'll appreciate this. Really, when you go to the cash machine, what do you get? $20 bills. That may be our most common currency, and there is the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup.
Mm.
I've got the Snicker at $100. That's your $100 bill. That's the one that if we were, you know, doing some sort of international currency trading, we would just ship Snicker bars.
Now, here's the tricky part. What's the $50 bill? What's the obscure?
So, funny that you should ask that, because Sam Panionovic in sports sent me a text this week, and he said, I'm not even talking to you unless Twix make it in there and the Milky Way. So I, as a sort of nod to Sam Panionovic, have the Milky Way bar as your 50.
Well done.
I'd make a raisin at the quarter.
You're saying that the Milky Way is worth more than the Snickers?
Well, no, because you don't use a 50. I think the Snicker is,
I see.
Our most common currency.
I got it.
But Griffin, you're just picking a fight now. Really, nobody wants a Raisinette.
I like Raisinettes a lot.
You know, that's just you showing off now. Nobody wants a Raisinette.
Showing off.
Nobody. That's the hors d'oeuvres of Halloween candy.
Thank you.
It's all candy. All right, those chocolate-covered cookie dough bites, how about that? That's like negative money.
Actually owe me if I take that from you. Well, when you go trick-or-treating and they give you that little box of raisins, I know that's not Raisinettes, but...
Don't even bring it up in the same sentence. How dare you?
Nobody wants that. It's 10:39. All right, Griffin, 3, 2, 1, hit it.
6 weeks ago, a man died. Jumped through a six-story window with a sheet tied around his neck. Well, he didn't leave much behind. But he did have a climate-controlled storage locker filled with old vinyl records. Thousands of them.
If you could have any record in the world, what would it be?
I'm going to tell you a really good story. Misery, come on.
10:41 now. This is WGN Radio, John Williams in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. It's raining out there. It's dry in here. And this is actually a good day to go see a movie or some of the movies as part of the Chicago International Film Festival. We'll talk about that a little bit today with a couple of the filmmakers. One of the movies that's being featured at the River East downtown is Chasing the Blues. Here's the reader's description of it. In 1987, a white record collector, Grant Rosenmeyer, and a black record store owner, Ronald Connor, discover that an elderly black woman in Hyde Park owns a rare blues recording. The men's attempts to steal the disc end in disaster. But 20 years later, they jump at a second, much riskier opportunity to secure it. Writer-director Scott Smith offers some knowing jibes at the white appropriation of black culture, but the comedy is generally goofy and high-spirited. Rosenmeyer and Connor are great foils, and Horsford, with her sweet tea and southernisms, nearly walks off with this movie, with John Lovitz, who you heard in the trailer, Steve Guttenberg, who you see at the end, and Tim Kazurinsky are all in this movie. So the star and the writer-director in our studio. Guys, welcome to the show. Hi.
Hello.
So where do we start? Where did you get the idea for the story? I mean, was this some legend that you sort of appropriated, or was this an idea you always had?
I didn't have it. It came from the brilliant mind of Kevin Guilfoyle, who wrote a short story. And our producer, John Fromstein, found it in a book of short stories and sent it to me and said this would be a great short film. I read it, and I was like, oh, my God, this would be a great feature film.
Was the original story set in Chicago, too?
It was, yeah. It was based on, yeah, it was a Chicago chronology of, or is it anthology?
Well, it depends on what you're going to do with the second half of the sentence.
Yeah, what are you
going to
say? Wow.
Like, shoot.
Comma. of Chicago. Let's just move on.
So, yes. Grant, how do you then fall into this, right?
I fell in about... I think
you're the co-star or star.
Yeah,
you're in every scene
I fell
virtually.
In about 8 days before, and it was just one of those things where my agent called me and said, We have an offer for you to be in this movie. They didn't tell me anything about it, and back then it was called Death Take Two, which is based on the record is Oh Death, Where Is Thy Sting, and then the particular MacGuffin of this story is Death Take Two. And so I assumed that I was being offered the lead in a horror sequel. But I read the script and there was no horror, but it was really funny and kind of screwball.
Yeah, it's there are times where it's making very interesting points. Other times it approaches madcap. There are times I think it's about this chase for a record, and other times I think it's about chase for things for their own sake, and we don't pause to see what the value of it is. I mean, there's a lot of ideas that are in this story in an hour and 17 minutes.
Hour 20 or so.
Yeah.
But I love that synopsis. That who was that? The Chicago
was in the Reader.
Reader.
Yeah.
I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have said it better because it's so hard to explain the film because it is kind of.
It really is. I mean, it's hard even just doing a log line. But you know, when I explain it to people, I just tell them it's a dark comedy and it's got blood and laughs.
Yeah. And it's funny though because there probably are people, and if it's not a record, it's a baseball card
sure.
or something.
Sure.
That they just have to have, and for some reason they attach value to
it. Yeah. And the thing about, the thing about music, which I guess is different, is that, one, it means something different to everybody, and it's an emotional connection. And so for us to, kind of to do the appropriation of the blues and the white guy kind of challenging that, I mean, he's naive to it because he's just, man, I'm just reacting to the music. I love the
Who's
music.
Naive? The white guy.
Me.
Yeah.
Well, but there's a scene in the movie where the black guy,
right.
who also runs the jazz, the used records store,
right.
says, that's the problem with you. I'm going to not do this properly, but you white people, you're sort of appropriating or borrowing or buying our culture. I lived it. This right. is me.
Right.
And he thinks that your love of the music is illegitimate because of that.
Right.
I can only see the movie through my own filter, but I appreciated your pursuit of the record. I actually believe that your character loves the music, too.
Yeah, it was kind of colorblind, and that was
Yeah, exactly.
I showed the movie to my mother, and that was one of the first things that she said was how it does kind of treat race relations in a really nice way, to have these, it doesn't beat the audience over the head with the race relations. It's just something that comes naturally out of it, Alan's passion for the music, we're not really sure where it comes from, but it's, you can assume it comes from somewhere deep, deep inside.
And so that's something you had to be cognizant of,
yeah,
too. You
want
to make the point, but you don't want to be heavy-handed about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was definitely a thing that I wanted to put in the script. And, and they did just a great job carrying it out.
There's a couple of times in the movie where I think, oh, I see where this is going to go, and then it doesn't. It's sort of, there's a punch. And then it backs off, and then it continues to tell the story. And kudos to you for that, because it's a
thank you.
It's a trap. Maybe you
Great
don't
job,
want.
Man.
It's a trap you don't want to fall into unless you're going to make a movie about that. It could have been very distracting that way. So they so there's this record that this old lady has, and lo and behold, she has the holy grail
right.
of what record collectors want, and you sort of stumble upon it. But then lo and behold, your nemesis, this other guy, happens to be there too. So now, how are you two going to resolve this, right?
We're not going to tell you that.
I know. Well, so I can say that.
Right.
Really, this is one of the movies where, let me say this, guys. The last 60 seconds of the movie, you cannot anticipate. You
right.
literally do not know how this movie's going to end. It's the resolution and the movie's over, right?
Yeah.
Are you guys happy with, is it a happy ending? Is it a sad ending? Is it a dramatic ending? I mean, I presume you like the way it ends.
Yeah, absolutely. And we being Kevin and I, when we were writing it, had a million different endings. I mean, I don't even know if you knew about this.
We never talked.
Yeah,
well, don't say what it is because
this is the opposite.
But I'm just going to tell
they
you.
They all live.
At one point, we had Jimmy Cain Baldwin, who is the one who actually made the record back in the 30s as an old man, coming back and behind this whole thing that he was looking for the record. So he was the guy behind setting all this stuff up. Anyway.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but that was too complicated. So...
Yeah, so, that would have really worked with the timeline.
Well, but if I may, was there really a sort of Holy Grail old blues record, and afterwards the artist dies and everybody wants that record? I mean, is there a version of this in popular music culture?
There must be.
It's generally totally fiction, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
But it could be almost anything at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then how does a Steve Guttenberg or I haven't seen John Lovitz in a while. He's really good in this movie.
Yeah.
And first, what's that all about?
Well, I mean, much like Grant, you know, when you're casting and using casting agents and all that kind of stuff, there are a lot of actors, agents who are involved, and Steve Guttenberg and John Lovitz happen to have the same agent. And so he picked it up and sent it to Guttenberg. And actually, Guttenberg originally wanted the role that Grant played.
And I thought I was playing him younger. That's when I heard that he was coming on. I thought that, you know, I was going to play young Alan in the 1987 stuff. And I just assumed that he was going to play the older stuff.
You're both.
I'm both, yeah. But that was it was a funny conversation when
And boy, is he ticked about this, too, by the way.
I mean, he was. He wouldn't talk to me on the set. really just threw shade at me. Right? No, he's the nicest guy.
But he, you know, and it was a hard conversation, but he wasn't exactly right. And I think when you see the film and see how Grant handles it, which is what I had imagined is the way, but nonetheless, he wanted to be a part of the film, and so we talked, and he got this role. And then at the same time, the agent sent it to Lovitz, you know, for some reason, which I didn't imagine. I didn't imagine John as in the role of Groom. I had it in my mind a little different.
Who did you imagine?
Well, it's been a host of different kind of things. I mean,
Lovitz is a well-dressed kind of dandy of a guy who's got a bit of a southern accent, and he's a little bit of a conniver. He's representing the estate. He's going to resolve this issue.
Right. I mean, originally it was somebody who's a little darker.
Give me a name.
Him.
Give me a name. I want a name on my desk.
You know, like who could play that like a Morgan Freeman? You know, someone who just plays it super, super serious, super straight.
That's ambitious, isn't it?
Well, you asked me to give you a type.
But we got John Lovitz instead.
I mean, he really sinks his teeth
really
into
good.
It, though.
Well, yeah, it's a great character, and so he owns it.
And so when I imagined it, I was like, well, we could do something a little different with it, you know? And then I talked to John, and he's the one who brought the southern accent to it.
Oh, really?
Once we started, he was like, yeah, I'm thinking of doing a southern accent. How's it? And I was just like,
well, at least he didn't do the liar, right?
That wouldn't have fit.
Lovitz is famous for, among other things, being the lying character on Saturday Night Live for a while and was really good at that. He was supposed to join us today. His flight didn't work out, so he couldn't. But I was wondering, do I ask him about that, or is he tired of talking about that character?
I feel he'd probably be tired about it.
Okay, you know, another question I have for you guys, though, is when you make a movie like this, a small movie, an hour-plus long movie for an international film festival, how is this thing financed or budgeted? And I'm kind of curious about whose credit card was used on this, or maybe not. Maybe given the cast that you have, it doesn't go that route. Tell me about that in a minute. Chasing the Blues is one of the movies that's being shown at the Chicago International Film Festival. If you go to chicagofilmfestival.com, chicagofilmfestival.com, you'll find out more about movies like Chasing the Blues, etc. In our studio right now are Scott Smith and Grant Rosenmeyer. Grant's the star, and Scott is the, what is it then, co-writer? Is that what you are of this movie, per se?
Co-writer and director
yes. Of the movie. Now, it's probably sold out for today. I understand that you can't get tickets probably to today's show. You might check online or see if there's rush seats, but you can go to see it Wednesday and next Saturday downtown Chicago. A movie like this gets financed how?
Well, there's several ways an independent movie gets financed, and one of them, as you said, is, you know, you can max out credit cards. But the best way is to have other investors do it. I was not a part of that, and I stayed away from that. I got involved when John, the producer, said, okay, I think we're a go. We can start. But he, you know, raised money.
Is this a million-dollar movie?
Ish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there were times where I thought, boy, it looks just like a Hollywood movie, you know, like a big time expensive movie. But then other times you go, no, it's short and maybe it's not. And so I was trying to figure that
out. Yeah. I mean, the production values we had were, I think, amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been in advertising for over 20 years, so I've had a lot of experience doing commercials and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, there's things that I've learned from that, I think, that have helped, you know, up production values.
So then what's the hope for a movie like this?
Ideally, it would be great to have it picked up by a distributor. So a distributor would buy it, and then he has territories, whether it's domestically, international, gets distributed to screens, Netflix, Amazon online, all that kind of stuff. And that's, you know, one of the objectives coming out of these film festivals. We'll be in Austin at the end of this month, and then a Lone Star Film Festival as well.
Feels like a hot day in Chicago when you're watching this movie.
Yeah.
It wasn't that hot. It was actually so pleasant while we were filming, which is always the opposite. I feel like when you're shooting something, it's supposed to be a perfect day, and it's either blisteringly cold or swelteringly hot.
Yeah, I wanted to have some other outside tension. And originally, another thing.
It was snow, right?
It was snow. But from a finance standpoint or a budget standpoint, they were just like, dude,
it's easier to go,
dude,
boy, it's hot than create a snowstorm.
You got to rewrite this. So I rewrote it. I rewrote it to where it was like this, like stormy rain for like 3 days. And then they're like, no, try again. So I'm like, well, no one can see heat. Let's do heat.
Yeah, heat.
No one can see heat.
Complain about the air conditioning and that sort of thing.
And then we just have to act sweat. Heat.
Chasing the Blues will keep your attention until the very last scene. And you can see it Wednesday and Saturday and then down the road. But maybe don't wait till then. Guys, congratulations. Thanks for coming to the studio. My best
John
luck
Williams.
To you in the film. Yeah, I know.
I love that so
your music.
You know I'm not that one, right? I'm just talk show
what?
Host. It's 10:57. Thank you, Domitia. It's 11:09. This is John Williams on WGN. Domitia, I'm sorry. I'm reading about this fundraiser with the gun as the prize.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm not looking at the same story. Was that the Lake County Republicans whose fundraiser was last night that you're talking about?
That was, yes.
And so that went through as scheduled and somebody won the gun or something?
Yeah, it happened as scheduled.
Okay, so their explanation was, this is just what you said, and I'm just reading a version of it in the Tribune from Rick Pearson. Lake County Republicans moved ahead with a fundraiser where at least a dozen firearms given out to donors Friday night, less than 2 weeks after the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. The Second Amendment dinner and gun raffle in northwest suburban Killdeer featured an AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle for those who paid $2,000 to sponsor the event. Raffles for a 12-gauge shotgun, 9mm handgun, and other gun-related packages. And according to the Lake County GOP chair, Mark Shaw, they said, well, this thing was planned a long time ago. We didn't know that there was going to be the worst mass shooting. The timing's unfortunate, but we can't just cancel the thing or not give away the prizes. And I'm thinking, yeah, you can. Yeah, you can. You could, as Republicans, Democrats, if it was an NRA event, you still could have said, we believe in the principles of the Second Amendment. We appreciate how awkward the timing of this is, and therefore this year's event has been canceled, and all the money will be returned. Why was that so impossible for them to do?
And not only that, but a listener sent something. I don't want to confuse everyone, but there's yet another one that reportedly came in from a listener. It's an ad that they saw in a newspaper down there in Springfield where they're giving away 60 guns in 60 days. Now, this is from the ChristianCountyFair.com. $100 a ticket. Drawing dates are November 1st through December 30th, but yet another gun giveaway at just an inopportune time, many people would say.
Lake County Republicans held a fundraiser, and they went. So just, if I'm wrong about this, call me and just straighten me out. 312-981-7200, a text to that number. But then they went ahead with the AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle. That, in fact, happened last night? Last night? Are you kidding me? Wow.
John, you want to hear from Mark Shaw one more time?
Yeah.
The fact that the AR-15 is something that was unfortunately used by a crazed murderer in Las Vegas recently to kill a horrendous amount of people, we already had the product donated, and we weren't going to not go ahead and use it.
Why
because
not?
That would be disrespectful to the donor.
No, it wouldn't. Disrespect the donor. Really, if I gave you an AR-15 and the next day that happened, as the donor, I would say, hey, listen, I get it. Give the gun back. I'll write you a check for crying out loud. You cannot need $1,500 that badly. That is stunning. Okay. Well, that's why I get to have a show Monday through Friday here on WGN between 1 and 3 in the afternoon. That is not about the Second Amendment. That's about sensitivity. That's just about common sense. So let's do the Mincing Rascals podcast broadcast. Every week we record a podcast, which is one of the more listened to podcasts on the WGN radio platform. And it's because we have people like Eric Zorn, the Chicago Tribune columnist, Scott Stantis, who draws the cartoons for the Chicago Tribune on the editorial page. Kim Gordon filled in for us this week. Kristen McCreary couldn't join us. And our own Steve Bertram. The gang just fell into all sorts of what I thought were amusing tangents this week. We'll play back part of that podcast for you now. We begin with Scott Stantis, who is talking about the county board chair, Tony Preckwinkle, and that sweet beverage tax, which has been rescinded. And Stantis thinks that's a good idea.
We finally saw through this gauze of BS that said that this was for our health, which is, of course, finally Preckwinkle comes forward and says, you know, just leading up to the vote when she had her, you know, pre-vote hissy fit.
Okay, you're going to regret that.
Am I?
I think so. Go ahead.
Why, okay. Is that sexist?
Hissy fit?
Well, you can't say hissy fit.
You can't say hissy fit?
I don't think you can say
it. You know, every now and then the tide shifts on certain words and phrases. Hissy. I did not know that the hissy fit was in play.
I am going to say that saying hissy fit referring to a woman is ill-advised.
That does not rub me the wrong way.
Thank you.
She's an extraordinary woman.
Sorry, hissy fit does not bother me. It really didn't make sense because a Frappuccino is probably worse and more fattening than a regular Coke, but you're not getting charged tax for that, but you're going to get... you know, tax for a bottle of Coke.
You would get taxed for it if you bought it in a bottle, but if you bought it...
Right, but if you walked into Starbucks
barista,
and got it, right.
Yeah. By the way, hissy fit, if it's related to the word hysterical, I know this is not the important news of the day, but if it is connected, if hissy comes from hysterical, then it is arguably sexist.
Yeah, but
sexist.
It sounds like sissy.
You mean I think that's not good either?
I think we'd follow up on this next week after we've had a chance to consult our dictionary.
Here is another word whose, I think, appropriate use makes people blanch these days, and it shouldn't, only because of the way it sounds, niggardly. People hear that word, and they go, I don't know if you should say that. But the sound of that word is off-putting to people.
I wouldn't use it in casual conversation for the reason that you said. I mean, it's not related to the ethnic slur at all. There's no linguistic connection to it, but
what's the definition so the listeners can...
Cheap, no. Miserly.
But it does make your heart skip a beat.
Doesn't it? You say, squeeze me.
You
couldn't have said cheap or miserly. Right. Wouldn't have that helped?
That popped up politically about
somebody lost their job over it or
something. Well, remember, and Sarah Palin used the phrase tar babies once upon a time.
Well, that.
Come on. But I think a lot of us have never even heard of that phrase. I was unfamiliar with the history of that because I was unfamiliar with that phrase until she used it. And then I had to look it up and thought, if you knew that word or phrase, why in the world did you use it?
Well,
you must know.
I just did a column a couple weeks ago about the word dotard, D-O-T-A-R-D, which refers to basically a senile old person. It is not at all related to the word retard.
I pronounced it dotard.
Dotard.
I pronounced it dotard retard.
Right, but it's not connected to that word at all, but it sounds like it, so it's maybe a word that you might want to avoid.
Well,
especially
but
if you're
I think we've had
it.
A conversation about this, didn't you and I? How did the word dotard pop up? It was when
Kim Jong Un.
Sure, but I mean, the point is, where did they come up with that? Because you've got to believe that when Kim Jong Un said it, he didn't say it in English. He said it in Korean. They looked up that word.
Yes, is it a babblefish translation?
Because right,
I think
so
it
how
was.
Is dotard popping up in somebody's dictionary?
Someone using a comprehensive U.S. Korean dictionary from about 1945.
They've got to drop dotard out of there because we don't even know what that means.
Last one in. Yeah.
Is that where the word doddering comes from, by the way?
Next on Language Talk.
Since his campaign days, President Trump has consistently described a Chicago cop who he says could solve our crime problem. The speed with which this mystery cop could fix the problem has gone in various versions of Trump telling it from a week to 2 days to now immediately. That it is now immediately is somehow a news story, as if the president were caught in another fabrication. I think if the story is true or apocryphal, it really doesn't matter. We all know what the president is saying. He's heard from frustrated cops. They need to be able to crack down more. I don't think we need to call the president a liar because it's now immediate. Well, maybe this isn't fake news. This is distracting news.
Why don't we need to call the president a liar?
John, your issue is that he's first time he said it, it was said he could do it in a month. Then he said he can do it a day. Today he said we could fix the problem immediately. So you think that's why people are jumping on him because he switched it to immediately?
I think, well, that's the headline in one of the stories of the Tribune today.
I don't think it ever happened anyway. I don't know when.
But I mean, did you ever think that President Trump really talked to a Chicago cop who said we could fix it in a day? And even if you did, I mean, who cares? I probably will tell the president I could fix it in a day, but that's
right.
There's no meaning to any of this.
I'd like to know who the cop is. If he actually exists and he actually had an idea that could solve this
problem. The president said he gave the name to the mayor.
Well, the idea, Scott, obviously the idea here is,
and that name is not surfaced.
Is to ignore constitutional safeguards and mandates. I mean, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about. But I think, I mean, what else could solve this problem in a day other than, you know,
crack some heads,
incredibly unconstitutional. And our president has very little regard for the Constitution.
You said the president gave the name to the mayor?
He says he passed the name along to Mayor Emanuel, and Emanuel's people continue to say that never happened.
Yeah, I was going to say, they put out a statement after this latest one saying, please give us the name.
Okay, but really, we're missing the point. That's my problem. This part of the conversation misses the point.
But there is no point. John, he doesn't have an idea. There's nobody who has an idea.
The whole point is that he makes that it's a lie.
Well, let's go back to discussing the word hissy fit.
What are your thoughts about this?
You think it just has to do with the fact that here he goes again, just coming down on Chicago, always picking on Chicago?
The president is having a lot of trouble with the Constitution or safeguards for suspected criminals or journalists who say things that are either true and unflattering or are inaccurate as they try to do their best work. You know, sometimes they get it wrong. The president wants to actually suspend the license or put in jeopardy the license
of a network,
NBC?
Which they don't have.
I noticed that they sort of massage that. You can't suspend the license for NBC. The stations are licensed. Now they say, well, we'll suspend all the NBC licenses.
That sounds constitutional.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, licenses are renewed. I mean, you know, he doesn't make those decisions. The FCC does.
This is authoritarian rhetoric.
It really is. It's very scary.
And the first step is not to just run in and take over the media. The first one is diminish the existing media.
And discredit them.
To demean them and discredit them. And that's what. And so I just had to kick a guy off my Facebook page yesterday because he was saying, you fake news types, fake news. I go, okay, tell me what's fake news. Obviously couldn't quantify it. I doubt, you know, it's just another, you know, pro-Trump snowflake whining about coverage they don't like.
Are there pro-Trump snowflakes?
I thought snowflakes were the opposite. Oh, no. The pro-Trump guys are. They're snowflake. They melt like that.
Okay, we need another definition thing. Eric, what's a snowflake?
No, it's anyone who melts in the face of some criticism or some things.
I thought
that
was reserved for the left.
I really did, too.
But look at I think the right started it, but sort of all the people who have to stomp out of football games because they can't.
Did that on Weekend Update this past Saturday. Yeah. He said, who are these snowflakes? I think his reference was to right-wing snowflakes, but who can't take, no, Earl, you can't have, you know, 42
You can't
guns.
Shoot someone with six bullets. Use your words.
Wasn't that a great line?
Snowflakes are all different shapes and sizes, but they all melt at some point, right?
I got it. I want to ask you guys about this. Bill Clinton almost lost his job for a relationship with an intern. Bill O'Reilly lost his TV show. Bill Cosby lost his career. Harvey Weinstein has lost, it appears, his wife, his company, his life. The question to me isn't maybe when are they going to learn, these men. I don't think they're capable of it. I don't think it's something that they can learn. I think the question is, when are we all going to learn to either institute better personal or professional safeguards for people, or once we find them, to rat them out sooner? I am mad at almost every one of these stories this week, and Steve is mad at me for that.
I am mad at you for that. I don't like the, you know, I didn't mean to sound mad at you yesterday.
You were mad at me, and you sounded mad.
I'm sorry that I did sound that.
I think it was honest.
I wasn't mad
at
you.
Mom and Dad are fighting.
I'm frustrated when these things happen, and now all of a sudden we're naming names. Oh, and, you know.
Jessica Chastain.
Matt Damon did this, and such did this, and this guy must have known, and he didn't come forward. Pull back. The bad guy here is Harvey Weinstein. Let me tell you my own story. I got a call once 20 years ago, and it was about someone else in radio who was a boss, a guy. And it was a woman who called me, and she said, hey, do you know, is this radio station hiring someone? I said, I don't know. She goes, well, you know, because such and such took me out for drinks, and, well, you know how such and such is, and he told me there'd be a job in it for me. Implication is clearly this guy hit on this woman, may have had sex with her, I don't know, with the idea that there's a job coming. Is it my responsibility to go to that guy's boss and say, hey, I just heard that this guy had some bad behavior? And if this guy gets discovered 15 years later and this woman says, oh, I talked to Steve Bertrand about it, does that make me the bad guy here
now? I don't know. Answer your own question.
No, it does.
You have zero responsibility to anybody for anything in this story?
I think that if there wasn't a crime committed or an attack made, if I didn't have evidence of a crime, I don't think I am responsible for risking my job by calling it out.
That's your scenario. But I don't think that's generally what we're talking about here. Mostly the criticism has been of the women who knew about it or were hit upon. Here's the analogy I've used this week. Tell me if this is apt. If I'm walking down the street and somebody robs me on Michigan Avenue and they've been there all week, don't I have an obligation to tell people, hey, there's a guy on Michigan Avenue who's been robbing people, whether I got robbed or not? That's why I'm mad at people who know and don't say.
Obviously, being a woman, I'm outraged. It's horrible. The thing that upsets me about Harvey Weinstein, all these people, is that it always happens. It doesn't matter. It's happening anywhere and everywhere. They just happen to have a lot of power and have gotten called out on it. How do we change the culture? How do we change the work environment? How do we change this? I don't know what the answer is. And our president has been accused of it, and he's still the president.
You know, I didn't put him in my little litany of people.
But he needs
to
be on the list.
But it's the exact same power play. When you listen to the Billy Bush tape, he says, when you're a star, you get away with it. Isn't it great? And Billy Bush is laughing. And Billy Bush loses his job.
Right.
And all the Bills lose their jobs in this story.
I think the difference is we're seeing it on the other side as a collective. We're seeing a collective of women or men. But each of the individuals or before the on the other side, on the previous side, it's all an individual interaction. And so it's easy for us to say, if there are 50 women here, everyone should have acted in concert.
You're right.
When it actually happened 50 different times.
It's very personal. It's very individual. You listen to the tape of Weinstein with that Italian Filipino model, Umbra, something like that.
Right.
And oh my God, is that
that was part of the New Yorker.
Dangerous. Yeah. Listen to the tape if you haven't. Let's not insert it all here, Ella, but let's put a link to it because it's telling.
Why yesterday you touched my priest?
Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
Are you used to that?
Now, his badgering of her in that tape is just. It's stunning. I mean, it's if you were going to write a script for how the Hollywood executive sort of badgers a young female into doing something she doesn't want to do, it would sound exactly like that. And they've got it on tape. It's amazing. That's part of our podcast we call The Mincing Rascals. You heard Scott Stantis there, the editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune. You can see his Prickly City cartoon in the comic strip of the Tribune today. Eric Zorn, the columnist, and our own Steve Bertrand. Plus, Kim Gordon was able to join us today from WGN Radio News. And earlier this week when we recorded the podcast, we appreciate that. You can hear it all at WGNRadio.com. The podcast is called Mincing Rascals, or just subscribe to it for free wherever you listen to your finer podcasts. We still have a lot more to talk about, including Instant Replay in baseball, Dancing with the Stars, that Eminem song, Project Runway, for crying out loud. I got a couple questions asked Mark Carmen, who's filling in for our own Sam Panionovich, about the Cubs this next series now. The series starts, what time, what's tip-off time tonight, Carm? It's, I think, Griff, do you know what the start time is? We'll take a pause here and catch up in a minute. It's 11:24. Thank you, Domiti. This is John Williams. It's 11:40. You're listening to WGN Radio. Amy Guth's ready to entertain and inform you in about 20 minutes. Okay, so Mark Carmen's in for Sam Panionovich today. We sure appreciate Mark being here. I'm going to be with some people. I'm going to be watching the game. Give me some things I can just drop in casual conversation and they'll think I know what I'm talking about. Like I'll say, you know, we can hit Dodger pitching. This Kershaw guy we own.
That would be good. I think
give me another one.
I would throw in there, you know, this Cody Bellinger, he wasn't with the Dodgers last year. He's going to be the rookie of the year. He's actually a borderline MVP candidate. And by the way, you know, his dad actually was in the majors as well. A little different, though. This guy, he barely played in the minors. His dad had a slave for 10 years before finally getting his chance. So something like that, John.
Nice, nice. Okay, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
So we can hit their pitching. Can they hit our pitching?
And that's, you know, another thing. You know, you can feel very confident that, you know, even if things go wrong, John, you can bring up, you know, the Cubs were down 2-1 against the Dodgers last year, and Kyle Hendricks came back and pitched great, and John Lester's has always been solid against L.A. in the playoffs,
right.
Stuff like that.
What do
be
I
good.
Say if they say, yeah, but Madden loses his mind in the playoffs and mismanages the pitching. What do I say then?
You say, I completely agree, but it hasn't mattered.
I mean, what did you think about the NLDS in terms of pitching and stuff?
No likey. I do not believe in what Joe Madden does in the postseason as far as how he handles the pitching staff. I would
overthink it. These guys are professional pitchers, and some of them are pretty good, and he's pulling them too soon and then putting in somebody, okay, but it's all on this next guy. It's all he better not give up a grand slam.
I would have pitched Quintana after Hendricks in Game 5 and let him run as far as they could as far as he could go, as long as he was effective, and then go to the bullpen. But he sort of did it the opposite because I think, John, I do think that Madden and Theo and company were trying to have their cake and eat it too. If we only use Q a little, he's probably fine to start on Saturday against the Dodgers. So, and I was going back and forth during the game. I mean, you're trying to win the whole thing, and if you feel like you need Quintana to start out against the Dodgers, maybe that's why you're doing this. And
well, you got to win but planning for the Dodgers didn't do any good if you can't get past
right
the Nationals.
Right. Well, then it just doesn't make sense.
But for a couple of lucky breaks, we don't even win Game 5?
Well,
I mean, they got that call wrong on the follow-through, right?
Yeah. Baez definitely hit the catcher
with his bat in the
head. So in by baseball terms,
that's a strikeout.
Well, yeah, it's a strikeout, but he's still got to catch the ball. Now, the ball...
I thought it was a dead ball after that point, and so that throw into right and all that doesn't even happen.
Correct, but the interpretation of the rule by the home plate umpire was that the ball was well past the catcher at that point, so him hitting him in the head was incidental, and it didn't affect the play. That is why he thought he got the call right.
You don't think getting... Listen, I'm for the Cubs on this, but you don't think getting conked on the head doesn't affect your throw to first base?
Well, and I think that's a very fair argument. So I do. Listen, that call easily could have gone against the Cubs, and it didn't. And the play at first, where Contreras throws behind the runner, and they go to the replay, and somehow, some way, they were able to find an angle where
I was amazed at that.
His foot was off the bag. I still haven't seen anything conclusive.
I haven't either. I can't believe that. Yeah, I had another question about that play and the play before it. Just this in general, and then we got to wrap this up. But, I mean, the Nationals just – that was such an ugly game. I don't know that either team deserved to win, but the Nationals certainly didn't play like a team that's going to, you know, win at all. I mean, if you play that badly at home in Game 5, then shame on you.
Well, the worst play, too, when Zobrist on first base – I forget. It's all a blur right now, John. I apologize. But the line drive shot to left field, Jason Worth is coming in. I mean, you make that play in your softball league.
I certainly do.
And he, you know, just blows it miserably.
How does he misjudge that ball?
I don't know. And I'm sitting there watching and thinking, Zobrist, are you running? Because most guys, they might not, you know, they just assume it's going to be cut. Zobrist got a great jump, and he comes all the way around to score. For whatever reason, I don't know if the moment got to him, maybe the history of the Nationals, they gave the Cubs a lot. The throw into right field by the catcher was brutal.
We're making other teams look jinxed and cursed, not us.
It's a whole new Cub, man.
Man alive. Okay, so we win this series? What do you say? Give me the game score.
Let's go with Cubs in 6. Why not?
Cubs in 6, says Mark Carmen. All right, Griffin, 3, 2, 1, hit it. The Los Angeles, hang out by the this is our 5-score segment. Mark, we're going to ask you to score things on a scale of 1 to 100. Don Mattie likes to play this game, too. All right, Griff, here we go. What are we listening to? Tell me what this song is.
St. Vincent. The song is called Los Angeles. When you look at it, it looks like Los Angeles.
Are you sure you got that right?
I am sure.
Los Angeles.
It's a nice little piece of wordplay in the song title there.
It's going to be confusing to me down the road, but all right, Los Angeles. And
is that going to affect your score? It's a song, they just put out the video for it. The song's been out for a little while, but St. Vincent is an amazing guitar player, singer, songwriter, sort of, I don't know, avant-garde.
I think I'm familiar with St. Vincent.
She's been around for about 10 years. This is her fifth album called Mass Seduction that came out yesterday.
Okay, so now we give a gut reaction, a quick score of that. Domitee, 1 to 100, what do you say about that song?
1. I kind of hate it.
Ooh. I'm going to come in with a 23. I'm not loving it.
What's going on here?
Mark Carman, 1 to 100. How much did you love that song?
I loved it. I'd go like 91.
91. Griffin
Thank
says...
Thank you, Mark. I'm like at 85. I'm excited to... I haven't listened to the rest of the album yet, but I've heard a couple songs. And it sounds good. I've been a huge fan of hers, too. So
I think that's your problem. You're not hearing that song. You're just appropriating your affection for the artist.
Because I like the music. There is a reason I'm a fan.
You're blinded by love, Griff.
That's what it is, Griffy. You got to be real, baby.
Yeah, but the love is inspired by the music.
Okay.
That's fair.
Yeah, it's fair. I like the music because I like the music. The score is high because I'm a fan.
We're talking
because
about
I like her.
We're talking about the song per se, but we're not going to judge your judginess. So go ahead, Griff. What else you got?
I'm very upset. Well, you mentioned the Eminem song, too. Sort of freestyle
rap. Have you guys all
rap.
Watched or listened to, I guess, both? But it's amazing to see the Eminem music video that takes Trump on.
I have.
It's not about Donald Trump per se when I'm asking you to score it here. Griffin is, I guess, but... I think it's really well done. Even, you know, just if you can be neutral on it and say, as a statement and as art, is that well done? Is that good? I don't suppose anybody can distance themselves from their politics on this.
I find it very hard to believe that anyone would be able to take it.
If you are from China.
Take it neutrally.
I don't know. If you're from Mars and we just said, this man is angry about something, what do you think of his expression of that anger in a music video? I think it's really well done. I'm not an Eminem fan at all. I couldn't name one song of his. I give that thing a 93. I think it's really well done.
Oh, wow.
Domitee?
I give it a 70.
70.
And this is because I'm a really serious Eminem fan, super big hip-hop fan.
No kidding.
And, oh, man, I love Eminem.
You are not in his wheelhouse, by the way.
Yeah.
You are not the prototypical Eminem fan, but keep going.
No, yeah, but if you're a hip-hop fan, almost everyone has Eminem in their top 10 as far as best lyricists. I think this was not his best work lyrically. If you are a hip-hop aficionado, if you really are an Eminem fan, the way he put his words together, he's done better before.
Give me a score.
70.
Mark Carman, sports.
I mean, I've never heard anything said better than what Domitee just went with. So I was going to give him a 98 because I thought it was powerful, but I'll lower it to I'm going to go 89, John. I'll give it an 89. I thought it was fantastic.
There you go, Mark.
I'm around Domitee. I'd go 70, maybe 75, but I think you're right. I mean, everyone always has to acknowledge his craft as a technician. Like, he is so good at rapping, but I've actually found his style to be grating in like the last 10 years. I don't care about when he has a new album out anymore, even though I know he's still really good.
He does have a new album out too.
At what he does,
because?
I don't know about if that's true.
I think they said this is he has a new album coming out, and the cynics are saying, "Well, we get what you're doing. You're throwing Trump under the bus to boost your." And image and sales.
And I believe you, John, he has one out. I think my confusion is just that he's been largely irrelevant lately.
That's the thing. I thought, really, Eminem is still out there? Okay. So then I watched the thing. It's barren. It's no instrumentation, no other musicality. It's just him doing this bald rap. And he's angry at the president, and he expresses it. So there that is.
I have no problem with that. The reaction was so strong from so many people who don't usually talk about hip-hop. And that can be
that's
annoying because there is anti-Trump rep that is out there, has been out here for, you know, as long as he's been running, as long as he's been political figure. It's a little annoying to see
response. Don't you think the Eminem thing matters? Because Eminem's fans are from Kentucky. They're from West Virginia. They're from Ohio.
But they're from all over.
His base, I'm a little out of school here.
A little.
I think he's... Hear me out. Don't you think he is risking alienating a lot of his fans when he says, I'm drawing a line, you're either with me or with him? Isn't that kind of amazing?
Yeah, but he's so established, and he's in hip-hop, a community that, you know, has generally rejected Trump. Like, you in a text, just compared it to the Dixie Chicks when they came out against Bush, and there's no comparison.
You think that was more brave and courageous what the Dixie Chicks did?
100%. Yeah, which I'm not mad at Eminem for making the song. I enjoyed watching it. It was cathartic for some of us.
What is the name of the song?
Felt kind
of
good. But
yeah, if you ever wanted to say something.
Well, it's kind of a freestyle, so I don't think it has a name. It was part of the BET Freestyle Cypher, but yeah, hip-hop is kind of drawing a line, so I think he... I think it was less brave just because hip hop in general doesn't like Trump.
And no, I mean, if you want to speak out, speak out. I think that's a good thing to do, but I'm not like stunned by the stand that he's taken. It's like, yeah.
But he's converted new fans, which is awesome.
That's true.
And annoying at the same time.
Can we do Project Runway now?
Okay.
Okay, Project Runway. This season, rate it. Carmen, go. Yes, how much do you like it?
I never watched it.
Thank you.
Got it.
Doma T, Project Runway this season,
1 to 100. Never watched it.
It's a pretty good season. Now that the twins are gone, particularly in some of the drama they've created. And by the way, here was the big drama this week. So one of the girls that got kicked off, she wasn't going to get kicked off, but they found out that she was illegally using a tape measure to design some of her clothes. And when Tim Gunn found out, he said, "Hello, designer, you have to leave right now." And off she goes. Oh, it was really a good episode.
Wow. Spoiler. I'm sorry I missed it. I have enjoyed the
sorry,
episodes.
Sorry, yeah, by the way, if you taped it, that's how it goes.
I actually don't like it when there's outside drama not related to the competition, because those shows are supposed to be comforting. Like, I know exactly what it's going to look like and what it's going to deliver every time. When the contestants actually fight with each other, I'm like, keep me out of it.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm going to be a little silly here and I'm selling it. That was what happened. And it's better now that two of the characters are off. But you're right. There's a little more drama than is necessary.
Well, some people love it. I mean, and I'm sure they were thrilled that there was like some drama to inject. But I actually go there for the template, not for awkward moments like
that. Give us one more, Griff. Something else you want us to score, 1 to 100.
Oh, this is more of a recommendation. I don't know if you've watched American Vandal.
I just watched 2 episodes
Netflix.
Last night.
I think it's the funniest thing I've seen in like 10 months. Or
guys,
I don't know, in a long time.
American Vandal. Is that on Netflix that we saw that?
On Netflix, yes. It's a new series that came out about a week or two ago.
A parody of Serial. And in this case, the crime is somebody who paints some obscene images on the cars in the school parking lot. And they tell the story about figuring out what happened from a sort of a...
It's like a true crime documentary.
And it's...
Mockumentary.
And it's really good. American Vandal. Thank you, Griff. It's 11:53.